Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. After authorities failed to track down some 150 cultural items stolen in burglaries 40 years ago, Santa Ana Pueblo formed its own team of investigators to try and bring them home. We'll hear from members of the team about the task ahead of them. We'll also talk to tribal officials about renewed pressure on the University of California system to comply with the law when it comes to repatriating thousands of remains and cultural items. That's all coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In what the South Dakota Attorney General calls the end of a three-decade legal saga, courts have upheld the extradition of John Graham. Graham was convicted of the 1975 murder of Annie Mae Aquash. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's C.J. Keene has more.
Annie Mae Aquash was an American Indian Movement activist whose long-unsolved kidnapping, rape, and murder shocked South Dakota and the nation in the mid-1970s. Her body was discovered in a rural area near Juan Blee with a gunshot wound which traveled up from the hairline through the head. State Attorney General Marty Jackley describes the crime as an execution and says he's confident in the result of the trial. As a former United States Attorney for South Dakota, Jackley has long been involved in the case.
Ultimately, Graham took issue with the Canadian extradition, and today, ultimately, the Canadian Ministry of Justice has affirmed and reconsented to the extradition. And so John Graham will remain convicted of the execution of Annie Mae Aquash and shall continue to serve his life imprisonment without the chance of parole.
Graham, a Canadian national, was arrested for the murder in 2003. He's now 70 years old. Jackley says he believes this bookends the legal saga.
I feel realistically this is the end of the road. This is the Canadian Ministry of Justice. This is the appellate stage. So absent a governor's pardon, I feel that John Graham is where he needs to be.
Prior appeals from Graham's team have gone to the state Supreme Court, federal courts, and now through the Canadian extradition process. For National Native News, I'm C.J. Keene in Rapid City.
John Graham will remain in South Dakota state custody. A federal trial began Monday in Anchorage for a class action lawsuit against the Alaska Office of Children's Services, or OCS. The lawsuit is on behalf of all children in OCS custody, which includes Alaska Natives and American Indians. Marsha Lowry is an attorney and director of a national nonprofit advocating for foster care reforms. She says they're helping with the lawsuit because Alaska's foster system has some of the worst outcomes in the country.
They have a very, very high maltreatment rate. They do not have the kids visited every month. That's a federal requirement. Children have to be visited because how else can you know whether a child is safe when you put a child in a foster home?
The complaint alleges OCS caseworkers have too many cases to be able to adequately serve families. It also alleges the agency has failed to place Alaska Native foster children in culturally appropriate placements, violating the Indian Child Welfare Act. OCS Director Kim Gui also took the stand. She said all OCS employees are working to make positive changes in the system and that the agency has taken steps to increase recruitment and improve training, and repeatedly said that OCS is only one piece of the child welfare system. Margaret Payton Walsh is Assistant Attorney General for the state and defending OCS in the trial. She says running the foster care system in Alaska is challenging.
It's especially hard in Alaska because of the size and the remoteness of so many of the communities, and we are doing the best that we can to manage the challenges that we have. And there are definitely challenges. Nobody is denying that. And I think critically in this context, we have very, very severe caseworker shortage.
The trial is expected to take 3 weeks. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We'll be right back. National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Minutes from downtown Anchorage, the Alaska Native Heritage Center is more than a museum. It's where Alaska Native traditions, languages, and arts come alive. There's always something new at the Alaska Native Heritage Center who support this show. More at alaskanative.net.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Tribes and several state legislators are calling out the University of California for its failure to return ancestral remains and cultural items as required by law. The university system still possesses thousands of Native American remains. The Interior Department revised the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act to speed up repatriation by federally funded universities and museums. Critics say the University of California system is among institutions that are not complying with the new rules. We'll hear more coming up. First, we want to talk about work by a team of investigators at Santa Ana Pueblo. They are taking up the job of tracking down roughly 150 irreplaceable items stolen in a string of burglaries 4 decades ago. Officials believe the items were eventually sold by auction houses to collectors all over the world. At the time, authorities caught the perpetrators, but neglected to try and retrieve what was taken. You can join this conversation today by calling 1-800-996-2848. Is your tribe working to repatriate sacred items or the remains of ancestors? Tell us about it. We're also at 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now in the Albuquerque studio is Myron Armijo. He is the governor of Santa Ana Pueblo. Governor Armijo, hello and welcome to Native America Calling today.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing really well. Thank you for asking. Also in the studio, we have Monica Morell. She's the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer and Director of the Santa Ana Historic Preservation Department. Monica, hello to you as well. Great to have you on the show.
Hello, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Joining us from the Washington, D.C. metro area, we have Shannon O'Loughlin. She is the Chief Executive and Attorney of the Association on American Indian Affairs. She's a citizen of the Choctaw Nation. Shannon, hello, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Hey, thank you, Sean. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Joining us from tribal lands near Redding, California, is Jack Potter Jr. He's the chairman of Redding Rancheria. Good morning, Chairman Potter. Welcome to our show today.
Thank you for the invite.
And joining us from Las Vegas, Nevada, is Edward Halealoha Ayau. He is the executive director of Hui Iwi Kua Mao. He is Native Hawaiian. Edward, good morning to you as well. Great to have you on the show. Thank you so much, Edward. Appreciate it. All of you, really everyone, being on the show today, very, very, very privileged to interview you today. And Governor Armijo, I want to begin with you because we mentioned earlier about 150 items stolen from the tribe, stolen from tribal members' homes more than 40 years ago. Now, these perpetrators, they were caught, they were prosecuted, but the items were never recovered. What prompted this recovery effort now after so many years?
Well, Sean, this started with our TIPO office and a gentleman from our conservation officer group, an investigator. He started looking at these items that were stolen. And so more recently, as he started his investigations and finding different pieces out there, we had to pull a trigger on a story on the AP wire, and this went all around the world. We're happy that that happened, and our office started receiving responses from a lot of different people. And so, we're just glad that we've been able to retrieve some of the pieces from the East Coast here in Santa Fe. So it's been quite a job for our Historic Preservation Office, but they're more than our experts. They are the team that's going out there and making sure that we track down every piece that's out there that was taken from our pueblo.
Well, I want to talk more about the items that have been recovered, specifically a bowl, and we have a picture of that bowl on our website. But first, Governor, do you know why authorities never tried to recover the items initially?
Well, the perpetrators were caught one night. One night, that the sitting governor at the time had his officers out there, and the perpetrators were caught. Now, I'm not sure why. Maybe the Bureau of Indian Affairs never really maybe took the case on. And it was just people always thought about the items that were missing, Sean, never really let them go. And as you know, Sean, being from Laguna, those pieces have spirits with them. And to take those items from our homes was absolutely an atrocity, in my opinion. And but we never took on the issue until the last, 2 years? Yeah.
Okay. Listeners, if you go to our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com, there is a photograph of a bowl that was recovered. And Governor, what more can you tell us about the significance of this? How old is it? What was it used for? And where is it now?
We brought the bowl back to the pueblo. The owners of the bowl, the family that had the bowl in his possession back in the day, we brought them to the tribal council room, and it was quite the emotional situation for the family. I mean, there were tears of joy that this piece had been retrieved. I mean, this is a large piece that was taken back in the day. And so it's just, I can't express enough thank you to our office, the Historic Preservation Office, for the work that they're doing, Sean. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand there's also a war shield that you would like to see returned as well. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we brought one shield back from the Peabody Museum in Boston, and also another several pieces from the University of Virginia early last year. And so we're on the trail of these items, Sean. You may have heard maybe one of the news announcements that went through, we're not going to give up. These are pieces that belong to the Pueblo of Santa Ana and its community members.
Mm-hmm. Governor, thank you. I want to ask Monica Morrell now for her insight to Monica, this team of people who is working on the investigation. Tell us more about who you have assembled.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Sean. So we have three employees at the Tribal Historic Preservation Office. We have Jarrett Lujan and Thomas Armijo, who's with us here in the studio as well. And then, so the TIPO, you know, me and Jarrett and Tom teamed up together with Officer Woody, who's a conservation enforcement officer for the Pueblo. He has an extensive background working Archaeological Resources Protection Act and Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act cases for various federal agencies. I think most recently the Bureau of Land Management. And so when he joined the conservation and enforcement team, we had that law enforcement angle to add to our technical expertise on Santa Ana material culture. The first thing that we really did was track down all of the case files. And we really want to thank the Tribal Resources and Tribal Enrollment Department for getting us the first summary case file that was given to the Pueblo subsequent to the thefts. That was really the case numbers that we needed to go to then to the BIA and to the FBI to start asking for all the files. And it was a colossal effort. It took about maybe 5 to 6 months just to dredge up all of the case files alone. So we then had detailed descriptions of each item that was stolen from each different household. And so at that point, once we looked at all of the lists of everything, the comprehensive lists, then we started kind of working at the back end and looking at, you know, items that would show up in auctions or show up through private antiquities dealers that suddenly appear in the, you know, late 1980s that had no previous provenance whatsoever, and starting to look at whether, you know, matching those items up to the descriptions of items that had been stolen from the community, from different residents, different households. That was when we would find an item that matches and you know, talk to the members of the household to see if we could get positive ID. And so that's kind of the process that we've been using in order to match things up. And it's very tedious and very time consuming, but we're just working one item at a time.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me almost like looking for a needle in a haystack. I mean, these items could be anywhere in the world, foreign countries. Monica, what have you learned about the antiques trade during this investigation? Because it seems like ideally this shouldn't happen. People should realize, hey, wait a second, this item could be stolen. We need to check on this. How does this all go through?
You know, it's been a little eye-opening to me. I mean, obviously as a historic preservation specialist, we don't look at, you know, these items of cultural heritage as commercial items with value. But of course, it's certainly, you know, a big business. And it's really hard because a lot of the dealers that have been working with us and cooperating on the case really didn't seem to do their due diligence to figure out whether or not the items that they were receiving were stolen. And, you know, tracking down provenance, it's not the same on the commercial market as it is in the museum world. But certainly museums have picked up items. They expand their collections all the time. And, you know, one of the more recent items that the Pueblo repatriated back was a very large dough bowl that also came onto the commercial market in the late 80s and is suspicious to us. And that's when the provenance starts.
All right. We're talking with Governor Myron Armijo from the Pueblo of Santa Ana, along with Monica Morrell. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Journalist Joseph Lee turns his own exploration of his Wampanoag identity into an expansive look at modern Native American life in his new book, Nothing More of This Land. With his own story as a jumping-off point, Lee personalizes the history of his tribe and homeland. We'll add Lee's work to our Native bookshelf on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Goes out to all the war mongrels on the world. We don't want no more bombs to destroy our creation. We gotta stick to the father's plan.
Ooh, yes.
Ease up, Mr. Bush. You already got Saddam. We don't need no more war down there. We there a fat one. Sharon, what you gonna do? Rise up!
We the people are in a situation. It's we the people that need us a resolution. And if we see what's going on across the nation, it's gonna take more than a war and words from the Constitution. It's gonna take love.
Thank you for tuning in today to Native America Calling. We are talking about recovering stolen items, Santa Ana Pueblo is taking on the detective work of tracking down important cultural items taken decades ago. The items fall outside the scope of NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Please join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Santa Ana Pueblo, just a few miles north of Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is the community who we are discussing today here on Native America Calling. And Monica Morrell is the Santa Ana Pueblo Tribal Historic Preservation Officer. And Monica, like we just mentioned, I mean, NAGPRA doesn't apply here. Tell us more about the legal avenues that are available to your team to reclaim these items. I'm also curious, like, say you go to a collector and they say, look, I didn't realize this was stolen. I paid a lot of money for it. Is there any obligation for anybody to provide any compensation? How does this actually work?
Well, so yes, there is a provision I understand in NAGPRA that's against trafficking specifically, but really it's more of an ARPA issue, the Archaeological Resources Protection Act. And in that act, any cultural item that's over 100 years old is considered an antiquity. And so there are provisions in ARPA that would apply. Really, we're working in more of the larceny realm at this point. And there are certainly collectors that have realized, because we want to really be fair, that a lot of the collectors may not have known that they were buying contraband, that they were buying stolen items. But when we have approached them, it's been a mixed bag, and there are technically laws. You know, while it's not illegal to unknowingly receive and sell stolen property, it is illegal after you have, you know, found out and been informed that, you know, you have acquired and sold stolen property, that there are laws. And we're working with the Shield right now, which we specifically think is in Canada. And there are certainly laws that apply there as well.
Mm-hmm. Governor Armijo, NAGPRA, it's a powerful tool for tribes to repatriate some items. And there's also a law to prevent auction houses in the U.S. from trafficking in stolen items. But what else do you think could be done to prevent the type of situation that Santa Ana Pueblo is in right now?
Well, the Native community should be on guard, even today, of these people who are out there that could be planning to take these antiquities and items from our communities. It's important that we remain vigilant, and when these items come up on the net somewhere, if we find out, we will go after it. But one thing that we should probably do is, if this ever happens again, every governor that's sitting should go after these people. We shouldn't allow them to take these items from us and hurt our communities. If it was up to me at the time when these perpetrators were caught, I would have taken them to court. And one thing that I always thought about, Sean, was to bring these people to the Pueblo. Bring them to the Pueblo and show our community members, here are the people who took these items from you, from your homes. I was impacted. Our family was impacted, Sean. Our shield, my grandfather's shield was taken. To this day, we have not seen it. One day, I hope that we will see it again. There's a couple of shields that look like it, pictures in books in different places, but it's not the shield that that our family owned or my grandfather had. So, but that's what I would do.
All right,
Sean.
Thank you, Governor. I want to bring Shannon O'Loughlin into our conversation now. She is the chief executive and attorney of the Association on American Indian Affairs. Shannon, you've been on our show many times, and you've talked before about some of these challenges that tribes like Santa Ana Pueblo face. There aren't a lot of legal options to get back items that were stolen and then sold to private collectors. And that's the key here, private collectors. Can you tell us more about this process this many years later, 40 years, to recover stolen cultural items and ancestors?
Thank you, Sean. That's a really good question. It's a really complicated question. And what Santa Ana Pueblo is sharing with us is really how complicated it is to do that very thing. So once objects have been stolen and are out there in the world, it becomes really difficult to follow them. And I think I really want to pay attention to that the dealers, the folks that are selling these items and that are trafficking in these items, even in the 70s and even in the 1870s, who were doing this, they're very well aware of what they're doing. They're very well aware of the importance of these items to Native peoples and their nations. And so, pleading ignorance or that they didn't know these items were stolen or improperly obtained, especially in this day and age with NAGPRA and our understanding of what it means for a private individual to hold a piece of Native cultural heritage or a sensitive sacred object. There's no room to plead ignorance here. They know very well of their actions. And once these items are out in the market, there are various ways that traffickers will take them. Of course, there are these traffickers have links to different people who want to buy these types of items. So the network of people who are buying and selling improper items is known, and these auction houses that participate in this is known. But like Monica mentioned earlier, the auction houses and dealers don't do any due diligence to really show good faith that they're selling an item with good title. And so that puts the onus on the buyer to understand that most of the time, Native nations are going to recommend that you buy contemporary Native art from Native artisans, and that anything that is of quote-unquote antiquity or a cultural object, those items are more than likely stolen objects on the market and shouldn't be purchased. They shouldn't be invested in. Our laws are changing. People are becoming more aware of the problem with trafficking in our items, and that we're watching them. We're monitoring them. So we hope that these processes become less problematic over time, but right now it's really difficult to find these items in the open market because they are legitimately held back to increase their value and to potentially, separate them. Time helps to separate from the original theft, right? So it becomes harder and harder to bring something back the longer it's away from its home.
Shannon, in a few minutes, we're going to speak with Chairman Jack Potter of Redding Rancheria with regard to thousands of indigenous ancestral remains that are currently housed within the University of California system. Tribes and state lawmakers are putting new pressure on those institutions to make better progress. Can you put UC's situation in context for us? Is this a particularly egregious example of noncompliance, or is it just another instance of ignoring the law? I'm not clear.
Well, I'd really love to hear from Chairman Potter on this, since he's there in California and understand how this process has been working on the ground. I'm looking at it from a national level, and what I see is that the UC system and other academic institutions are all in the same horrible lack of compliance with NAGPRA. And a lot of it seems to be due to the kind of bureaucratic chains of decision making that happens in an institution. So it's very hard for those folks that are working with the collections, consulting with Native nations to actually easily return those ancestors as part of that collaborative consultation. Instead, they have to go up to one chain of title, up to the next chain of title, and through this bureaucracy of the academic institution, where individuals kind of take their shot to deny repatriation based on who knows what. So a lot of academic institutions have this very same problem. And another reason why I think the UC system is struggling here is because of the new NAGPRA regulations that passed in January of 2024. I don't think they know how to do NAGPRA under the new regulations. Those new regulations really set forward clear timelines and a clear process that institutions are supposed to follow to get this work done. So I'm holding, there was someone who said that this work is going to be done by 2028 in the UC system, and I'm really holding them to that promise. That means they are going to follow the NAGPRA requirements and those timelines to have this work completed by that time. But again, unless they change their decision-making processes, the work is going to continually get delayed and pushed back without return.
All right. Thank you, Shannon. Chairman Potter, please join the conversation now. I'd like to learn more about these remains that the University of California institutions have in their possession, and also just what types of issues you've encountered with regard to the UC system, and how is this working in terms of just consultation and follow-up and delivery?
Good morning. It's Chairman Potter, and it's very sad and disheartening. About 5 years ago, I went down there and I got a grandmother back with five grandbabies, and to see my people just in rows of shelves, and unless you know the specific catalog number, you can't put in that request. And, you know, it'll take years and years, and they just say, oh, no, we don't have this, but we may have that. But do you know the number? And it was good hearing the time frame of 2028, but they're going to be separating the items. They were like, we know you guys want to get your remains back, but the rest of the stuff, it may take 50 years. And I explained to them, I said, that's one and the same. You know, just like us modern day natives, when we bury our people, there's certain cultural things that we must adhere to when they begin that journey, certain items that must go with them. You know, over here we put acorn meal, and we put, you know, water, and we put other items that when they go as they're traveling on that journey to the spirit world, that they may come along things that they must make an offering to continue on, or maybe they've done things in their life that they need when they get there to make amends and offer that item up. They're holding those things, then that's what's going to take. And I said, do you hear us? Our people need to be at rest, and they're not going to be at rest if they don't have their personal property with them. You know, and that's what boggles my mind, that they can't comprehend that connection. And so when I was in there, I asked for a moment just to take it in, and I pulled out my cell phone and I started snapping pictures of, you know, stuff from my area. So I would have those codes, and we were working with one university and got so far. And then I think they didn't want to end up on the blemish list. And so they let go of all of their items and transferred it to the neighboring museum. So now we're back at square one and starting to ask for those items again when we were almost to the end, but they didn't want to look bad. So they said, oh, we no longer have anything. They just passed it on down the museum line. And it was crazy because I've seen more out of the area natives in Berkeley There was Dene, Apache, Passamaquoddy, Delaware. Tribal people from all the way over, you know, the other coast, down into Mexico, up into Canada. So I was like, if they're here in my land, how many of my people are in their land? So if we're going through the struggle here in the state to get back some 700,000 remains, what about the other states?
Right, right. I want to provide a disclaimer. We did reach out to the University of California for comments on this topic, but we didn't hear back from them before the start of today's show. Chairman Potter, the public concerns that you and state assembly members have made, are they having any impact on the willingness to address this lack of compliance? What, any headway at all?
I believe they are, and I think it's going to take the human race, because we have to believe, and like my grandpa always said, it's our role as Native people to doctor their minds, to educate them. You know, they may think that this is their area, but we're the only people that can call upon the spirits that live in our waters, that live in our sacred areas, that live in the mountains and the valleys. We are connected to every living thing. And that's what they don't understand, that even a rock is alive. And we have that connection. And with the help of those spirits, we'll be able to get these things back. And it tugs at some non-Native people's hearts, because like I shared with the provost, they were sitting behind me and I asked the assembly, I said, can they come in front of me? I said, you guys get it. You guys are passing legislation. You understand. But the ones that need to hear this are behind me. I want them to see my face. They allowed them to sit before me, and I talked personally to them about a dream I recently had where I went on that side. I've never went on that side. I've always had visitors. And as I went over there, I seen my gram and my grandpas, my mom and my aunties, and even ones that I've never met, and I was introduced to them. And there was this group of...
Okay. Chairman Potter, I want you to hold that thought. I'm going to let you continue this explanation of this dream when we come back from this break.
I'm Michael, and I used to smoke. I never used to think about breathing. Then my left lung collapsed, and I was diagnosed with COPD. Now I think about breathing all the time. I'm on an oxygen machine so I can breathe. I take medicine so I can breathe. My tip is, enjoy the breaths you don't have to think about. You don't know how long you'll have them.
Smoking can cause COPD. You can quit. For free help, visit cdc.gov/quitnow. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
It'll keep us around. Ooh, it'll keep us around. Maybe it's sunshine, maybe it's rain. Whether the weather, whatever we're feeling, maybe makes it all the same. Maybe we don't know where the wild things are going. Maybe the wilds of our mind feed the tide and keep rivers flowing with them. Real things, feeling them. Goes around. Oh, living is costly, but thinking is free. And maybe it's easy.
We're glad you're with us today on Native America Calling. We're getting updates on repatriation. In 2023, the Interior Department instituted new rules to the existing Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, calling on federally funded institutions to speed up repatriation processes. That means there's been progress with museums and universities working with tribes to return ancestral remains and sacred objects. You can join today's conversation. Just call us at 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. We have Chairman Jack Potter Jr. on the line with Redding Rancheria. And Chairman Potter, before break, you were describing a dream where you crossed over and you spoke with ancestors. Please, I'm gripped. So tell us more.
I went on that side. It was beautiful, beautiful river. And on that side, I could see all my relatives. And one of my great aunties was working on regalia. And I was like, what are you doing, auntie? Oh, she said, your uncle is getting ready to head this way. And that was her husband of 60 years. And he passed away 9 months ago. She said, when they get on this side, they can't have no Alani things. And when I looked across the river, I could see a pile of like white man clothes and white man things that were left on that side. And she hollered for my gram. Edie, she said, your boy's here. And my grandma came and greeted me and said, oh, there's your mom. And, you know, was talking to me about different things. And then my one great-great uncle was over on my left. And he looked upset, and I was like, uncle, what's going on? Oh, I'm waiting for your cousin. She's not doing right, he said. And before they're allowed to get over here, we, as elders of those families, have to correct them and fix them before they come here. But over to the right, I seen all these dark shadows, just dark shadows, and I couldn't understand what they were, who they were, and the people there didn't talk about them. And that day at the hearing, as I was sitting there, I kind of went into a little trance, and it came to me. And those shadows that I seen in my dream just weeks before talked and said, we are them, the ones you are here to speak for today. We have to get back so we could be part of that everlasting village, so we can be with our people. We were there, but we were taken, and now over there we're just a shadow, and we want to rejoin our people. And so I asked for the people from the UC system to sit before me, and I talked to them, and I explained to the lady. I said, just like you, I said, when you buried your grandmother, and I said, she told you she wanted a certain ring on her finger. I said, but you guys didn't do that. I said, and she's bothered by that. She wants that ring. I said, do you understand me? Yes, and they paid attention. And at the end, she came and said, Chairman, I got your message. She said, I don't know how you knew those things, but I got your message, and I understand now that connection. And I, we shouldn't have to be the voices of our people, but we are, and it's damaging to our spirits in these modern times, but I'm grateful. Like I said, we're the only people in this land, no matter who thinks they may own it, no matter what city's incorporated or what county or what state, we know what land we're in, that we were put down in by our Creator. And if we cease to follow those rules that each tribe was given, then we cease to exist. Even if we're wearing white man clothes or speaking English or whatever, those spirits know our heart and they know us and they'll communicate and they'll help us and be a complete people once again in the near future. Once we get these things home and get our items back. Because a people without belief and a people without religion cease to exist. And that's one of the only things that they could not take. They may have destroyed certain sites or removed certain rock outcroppings and stuff, but that spirit don't need that thing to continue to dwell there. it's still there. It takes us to get up and go to those areas mm-hmm. and fast and pray and meditate and do what we're supposed to do. And they'll start talking with us again. They'll start giving us instructions and direction and telling us our next move. And all with right. that help from that side, we can overcome anything because we're descendants from genocide. We're descendants from the most horriblest things, but we're still here and we each have a purpose. But we can't serve that purpose without the strength of our ancestors, without those spirits that have got them by and have gotten generation and generation and generation by. It's that same spirit that was put down by the Creator himself to help the people in that country. We have many countries across Turtle Island, but we know what we're supposed to do. And when we do it, look out.
Chairman Potter, thank you. Really appreciate a vision. We shared a vision with our listeners today, and I know that resonates with folks all over Turtle Island. Thank you so much. Phone lines are still open for anyone who would like to join this conversation. 1-800-99-NATIVE. Just pick up your phone, give us a call, share your insights. Let's now talk with Edward Halealoha Ayau. He is in Las Vegas, Nevada. And Edward, last year, I understand you were able to repatriate several hundred items from the University of California system, the system we're talking about today with regard to these issues with NAGPRA. Tell us more about what kind of work went into that effort.
Actually, this occurred in 2023. There were 335 cultural items that we consulted with the University of California, Berkeley, to repatriate. And I want to be real clear, out of those, only 10 of them qualified under NAGPRA. The museum returned the other 225 objects pursuant to a shared stewardship policy, an ethical returns policy that the university has. So that's outside of NAGPRA. They chose to return them, in part, I believe, because for years, the university wasn't complying with NAGPRA, wasn't responding to tribal claims for repatriation, largely due to the presence of a single individual, Dr. Tim White, who actively blocked repatriation claims. And we know that because we dealt with him in the early 1990s as one of the first repatriation claims under NAGPRA that was taken to the NAGPRA Review Committee as an appeal. And we're talking about two sets of remains. The university was fighting us over two human skulls, and which had zero scientific value to them.
Okay, what was the basis of their argument? Why were they fighting? What did they contend?
They were claiming that we failed to establish that they were Native Hawaiian, and therefore didn't meet the requirement of cultural affiliation. Even though their documentation indicated one came from a traditional Hawaiian burial site and the other was taken from a burial cave. So we were able to, the NAGPRA Review Committee, the first committee, met in Hawaii, was given dispute resolution training in one day, and the next day held the hearing between us and Berkeley. And it was interesting because Berkeley brought a lawyer, but the lawyer didn't argue the case. Dr. White did. Big mistake, since he may, be a qualified physical anthropologist, but certainly not an advocate. And I argued the case for our organization. And Dr. White actually made the case for us because he said that his biggest concern about our repatriation claim was that to return those remains would be the same as going into a library, removing two very important reference books, and then burning them. Because reburial and burning of reference books both represent the destruction of knowledge.
Hmm.
So he just compared our ancestors to books and said he only viewed them as sources of knowledge. The tension in the room was so intense that the chairman of the review committee kept cautioning the natives to calm down because tensions were running high. And then, of course, Dr. White says this. So I pound the table with both fists and say, the only problem is we are not descended from books. That was the most horrible analogy you could have presented, but it's indicative of how you think. And I said, this is an example of what we call intellectual savagery. Your intellect is so savage, it never once dawned on you that those are human beings and we are their living descendants, and how offensive your comment would be. That's how embroiled and lost in your science and how savage your thinking is. And that was enough. The committee voted to return them, except there was a glitch. So two things happened. One, we introduced, as part of our case, evidence that we knew that they were Hawaiian because we conducted ceremony with them at Berkeley. And the confirmation, the affirmation that we received from them, along the lines of what the chairman was just talking about, is that connection that we have with our ancestors, those on the other side, that was very clear to us. And so we asserted that as evidence. And if you read the committee's decision on the matter, they classified it as spiritual evidence that tribes are allowed and organizations are allowed to submit to prove cultural affiliation. So that was the first thing. But the second thing is, so they say, for the first skull, repatriate outright. There's cultural evidence, there's spiritual evidence, there's physical evidence, historic evidence. But the second one, they said, we recommended it be examined, and if determined to be Hawaiian, then returned. So we objected. We said, no. This is a preponderance standard. So whoever has the heavier of the evidence wins. The museum doesn't have a clue. We asserted our ceremony. You recognize that as evidence. And that's when we realized that even though they're recognizing it as evidence, they weren't giving it the same weight as everything else.
Edward, geez, this is a tough show to host today. I'm really moved by just hearing these stories and these anecdotes and these experiences that our guests have been through. And Shannon O'Loughlin, I want to go back to you because, again, this show, in some ways, there are messages of empowerment and pride, but then there are also just some of these stifling stories of oppression that just continues to this very day. I want to ask you, though, I mean, these institutions that are not complying with NAGPRA, what is the legal recourse?
And thanks for that question, Sean. So there is legal recourse under NAGPRA. Of course, there's always litigation available. That's an expensive solution and may or may not be workable. The first recourse can be through the NAGPRA Review Committee, which Halealoha was explaining how that process worked for him in 2023 and for those Native Hawaiian ancestors. Sometimes a review committee is sensitive, and other times, depending on the review committee and who makes up the review committee, they're not so sensitive. Other opportunities are through the civil penalty process in NAGPRA, in which anyone, any person, so you don't have to be a Native Nation, you can be a whistleblower within an institution. You can draft and even get support from the National NAGPRA program to draft a civil penalty complaint that asserts lack of compliance of repatriation under NAGPRA. So there are a few things available, both, you know, kind of official that will require the institution to pay money if they're wrong and help to move the institution towards compliance. There's alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, and there's litigation legal mechanisms for enforcement. But it is quite disingenuous that after 35 years of NAGPRA practice, that there are still institutions that will not repatriate and will not work eye to eye with Native nations in helping to repair and fix the problem that they created.
Shannon, how confident do you feel about the current administration continuing the momentum of NAGPRA work? So much progress over the last 6 years or so.
Yeah, there's been a lot of wonderful progress. I know the current administration and in his previous presidency didn't pass the NAGPRA regulations. We couldn't get those NAGPRA regulations passed during his presidency, and they were passed during the Biden administration. Of course, NAGPRA is a law that was passed by a Republican president, one of the Bushes, I forget which one. So this is a bipartisan piece of legislation, and of course we would hope that this administration is going to give it just as much of attention, but we're not for sure yet. The budget hasn't come out. We've heard from the National NAGPRA program that they've requested funding for grants, but we're not sure what that's going to look like. So I think in the next 30 days, we'll have a better understanding about how much money and support they're willing to continue to give to the National NAGPRA program to carry out these activities in support of repatriation. So hopefully that happens so we can all call our congresspeople and we can call the Department of Interior and tell them that this money is needed and to fix these continuing issues.
Thanks, Shannon. And with that, we are out of time. I want to thank all of our guests today, Shannon O'Loughlin, Governor Myron Armijo, Monica Morrell, Edward Halealoha Ayo, and Chairman Jack Potter Jr. Please join us again tomorrow for another discussion. We'll be talking with author Joseph Lee about his new book. It's titled Nothing More of This Land. It puts his own Wampanoag identity into both a modern and a historical context. I'm Sean Spruce. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for this program is provided by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles the issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. What AARP does might surprise people. For more information and resources, including member benefits, AARP advocacy, and more, go to aarp.org.
More than a museum, the Alaska Native Heritage Center represents all Alaska Native peoples in a living cultural center where the traditions, languages, and arts of Alaska Native peoples come to life through cultural programming and exhibitions, life-size village sites, live performances, demonstrations, and dynamic exhibits are all just minutes from downtown Anchorage. Open 7 days a week, there is always something new to discover at the Alaska Native Heritage Center who support this show. More at alaskanative.net.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.